Our next talk, Introduction in Internet Voting, held by Florian Moser. I will start with that now.
Thanks. So, hi all. Thanks for the warm welcome. So, I'm Florian. I'm a PhD student in Nancy. This is in France. I'm doing my PhD on formal proofs for internet voting. So formal proofs, essentially you specify your program in a very formal way. You specify what you want to have, so the properties you want to have. For example, if you're implementing TLS or HTTPS, so what we use to, if we access a web page, if you're implementing this, you want this to be secure. You specify this in a formal way, and then you do a mathematical proof that your specification actually fulfills the properties you want. And I'm applying this technique to internet voting. And so in this talk, I'm just going to talk about internet voting, not about formal proofs. So let me get right to it. So if you've heard about internet voting a bit, let's say in the hacker area, I'm sure you're aware of the DEF CON voting village. So DEF CON is a conference, let's say, that aims at non-corporate hackers. They have different villages based on different topics. So there's a village for cars where you try to break cars, a village also for voting machines where you try to break into voting machines. So can you break into voting machines? Of course you can. The security is often a bit discussable. So in the later example, some engineer liked to listen to music while apparently configuring the machine. Unfortunately, he forgot to remove the music afterwards. I hope he removed other viruses. You can invent candidates and have people vote for candidates that don't exist, but you can also make the machines do useful things. So, and now let me first separate. So this is in this talk, I will not talk much about electronic voting machines because I don't care. They're an entirely different set of problem. So I'm going to talk about internet voting. So what is different with electronic voting machines? So the difference here is people are there. So you have to go to the voting area, you cast your ballot there. And this means you as an election organizer, you have physical control over your voters and over your machines. So the solution here is not to secure these devices, which seems also to be hard to do. The solution here is to make the device verifiable. And one thing that you use in the US, not in all places, but hopefully they will eventually, are receipts. So you're still using the device, you're selecting your candidate on this touch screen, and then the device will register your vote, but it will also print out a receipt. So like if you go to a supermarket, you also get a receipt. It's also it's literally a receipt printer. And on this receipt, you will see who you have voted for. And so every voter can verify, well, on this receipt is really the candidate that I have selected. But he cannot remove this receipt, so it's behind the glass door. And then it falls into a ballot box, which is part of the voting machine. So, and then when the election is finished, what do you do? So every voting machine sends to you, in electronic means, it sends to you the votes it registered electronically. You sum this up, you get a voting result, and this voting result then says, well, this candidate get 10% more vote than this other candidate. And then you do randomized audits. So you select, I don't know, 100 or 1,000 voting machines. You check what has this voting machine claimed to have counted, and then you check whether the physical receipts you have there, whether they correspond to this. And so, you know, use a little bit of probability theory, and then in the end, you know how many voting machines you have to audit to get reasonable assurance your voting results were not meddled with. So, but what I'm going to talk about is internet voting, so you have no physical control over the voter or over the ballot box, so this approach does not work. So, you know, the obvious result, let's use blockchain. So this is Moscow. I think it's a system from 2019, and they, you know, blockchain was a bit hype. So three easy steps: encrypt the ballot, so encrypt your vote, store it on the blockchain, and then use a smart contract to tally. So the blockchain they were using was Ethereum, and they used Solidity to implement this tally. Now, I don't know how many of you have already used Solidity or have programmed at all, but you essentially have two bad choices in this system. So the maximum number you can store, so to encrypt something, you essentially multiply it by a very big number. But the biggest number you can store in this system is 256 bits. So if you're a bit used to key sizes, if you're using RSA keys, this should be a lot larger. So it should be around 2,000, 3,000 bits or even more, not 256. But it's the biggest number you can store. So of course there are techniques how you can split a very large number into smaller numbers and then multiply and so on. This would be the blue choice, but you know, it's a pain to do. It's possible, but it's painful. So you know, they went for the red choice. But they knew, it's probably a bit too small, this key. So what do? Well, you know, let's do it three times. So does this help? No, this does not help, because now you have one very, very bad key, and you have two, three very bad keys. So it doesn't help, but I mean, they tried to make the system public, so they published the specifications on, and this was found by a researcher in France, and he showed, well, you know, three weak keys, I can decrypt both, I can reverse both of these three keys, and on a standard issue laptop, the system is broken. They fixed the system. I don't know whether there are additional issues in the system. I don't know whether it really matters in the Russian context. So let me come to the targets of this talk. So what are the advantages and disadvantages? So these are the questions I'm trying to answer. So why would you use or why would you not use internet voting? How does the security of such system differ to other secure systems you're using? And importantly, how would you be able to detect a good or a bad system? So I'm not assuming you're cryptographers or you know or care about internet voting, but you know, what could be hints that the system you're looking at is not completely broken? So let's look at advantages and disadvantages. So first, of course, primary point is security. Now, I wouldn't say it's less secure or it's more secure than other systems. It's just, as in any good question in computer science, the answer is it depends. But what you can say, maybe it's probably generally true compared to a let's call it offline system, so compared to a voting booth or postal voting. In this kind of voting booth, postal voting, you have a lot of people that are involved. You know, you have the postman that delivers mail, you have the administration that stores the mail after you've voted, you have the people that count it, that sum it up, and so on. So there's a lot of people involved. All of these people are hard to control. So, you know, you don't know whether your postman is truly honest and, you know, doesn't have their own motivation. But on the other hand, it also doesn't matter too much. So even if one or two of these person is not truly honest, well, they cannot change the voting result too much. If you're going towards a digitalized system, you have fewer people that are involved generally because it scales better. So you need to provide the system once, but then whether 100 voters or 100,000 voters use doesn't matter too much. But you can formalize, but it's fewer people and you can control them much better. So there are system administrators and so on, you can make background checks and so on. You can make sure the people are not trivially dishonest, and you can much more formalize the process. So postal voting is, and just all voting booth, these are very long processes, a lot of people are involved. It's hard to really formalize what's going on. With digitalized system, if you do a proper analysis, this seems to be easier to do. So the answer is it depends. Let's go to the cost. So the answer is again, it depends. Again, what I think can be said in general, there are high fixed costs. So you need to develop the system, you need to maintain it. For example, this is a problem if you have election once every 4 years. If you let a software sitting around for 4 years, you essentially need to rewrite it because your dependency break or whatever. So high fixed cost, but it scales well. Again, if there's 100 motor, 100,000, doesn't matter too much. But again, the evidence here is a bit divided. So there's one country that has been running e-voting since a long time. And their i-votes, or their internet votes, they actually cost half of a vote that is cast in a voting center. But on the other hand, there's Switzerland that has also run internet voting for a long time. Here, on these numbers are the money you save. So assuming internet costing is for free, how much money you save per voter that casts per using the internet voting system. So, and these three cantons, so Genève, St. Gallen, Zurich, they essentially each said, well, around 4 francs per voter. So Switzerland is a democratic country, so we vote a lot. We vote around 4 times a year. So kind of these 4 francs, they're essentially the letter back to the administration. So this is the money you save. But this is without the system. And then if you try to calculate, well, how much a system development cost, it's hard to answer, but it's probably more than these 4 francs. And then, let's say from a more personal experience, I've been running elections in a university since a long time. For them, it has been clearly cheaper, but because they could essentially replace the paper they sent out by this electronic system. But on the other hand, again, so if you look at pricing of established systems, they're probably, again, not much cheaper. So yeah, the answer is really depends, and it depends highly on your context. But maybe at least it affects turnout. So one thing you can say, there are clear benefits for those that cannot vote in the traditional channels. So this holds for people that are just physically too far away, so expats or people that live in the outback. So this is from Australia and New South Wales. This is a region in Australia. So they have clear numbers. Well, after we've introduced e-voting in 2015, a lot more people participated. What has to be said about New South Wales, voting is mandatory. If you don't vote, you get a fine. So people are really motivated to vote, but some just can't. So this is the clear turnout increase. The other thing you can say, well, maybe you can validate votes. So there are some elections that kind of go wrong because people vote, but it's just all invalid. So to be fair, so Schwamendingen, this is a place close to, no, this is a part of Zurich, of the city of Zurich. And to be fair, they received wrong instructions how to vote. So those who read the instructions voted wrongly. Too bad. But if you look at general statistics, so some of the voting systems are complicated. So for example, in Switzerland, you have a list vote. You can remove candidates, you can add, but not more than twice, and so on. So some people do get confused. This number seems to be between 1 or 2%. So 1 or 2% of the voters that vote by mistake vote invalid. It's not much, but this can be prevented, but it's enough to change seat allocations and so on. And then one thing you could intuitively expect is that it increases turnover for the general population, but this just seems not to be true, or it cannot be statistically relevantly verified. So Geneva is a canton in Switzerland. They've been running internet votes for a long time, and they've been running it in some villages, but in some villages it wasn't provided. So you kind of have a good sample to compare to, and for them it didn't really change anything. So these are the three reasons, and in short, the answer is it depends. Good, so let's give it a try. So as any good engineer, you would first try to reuse an existing system. You would not try to develop one on your own. So let's give it a shot. Let's lose straw poll. So for those that don't know yet, actually the web page doesn't exist anymore. But yeah, you know, I love the iconic design. So is this a good voting system? Yes or no? So no, of course not. Would be too easy. So what you can arguably say is achieved, it's very usable. So you know, it's easy to use. Your vote somehow remains secret because you cannot easily see who voted what. But you know, there's two big issues. So one is fairness. This is sometimes a bit overlooked. So if you notice, you never receive early results. So the counting of the votes only starts after election Sunday, after all the voting booths and so on closed, because you don't want people to vote strategically. They shouldn't know the result before they vote, because else they might vote in a way to you know, they don't vote for their favorite party, but for their second favorite one, because they might get a seat and so on. So you don't want this. And the second thing you don't have is authentication. You know, there's IP duplication checking, but yeah, probably not enough. And there's also strong assumptions. So you trust the server, you trust your own device. Because the server could just replace your vote, the device could show you a user interface, but just under the hood doesn't do something completely different. So, you know, let's step up the game. Let's use Google Forms. So you have now your voting results are not immediately visible, right? You will, after I click on send, you will just see thanks for your submission, but I will not see intermediate results. It's also authenticated, so unless I'm able to, unless I'm a very good hacker and I'm able to create multiple Google accounts, I can only vote once. But what is clearly broken is, again, secrecy. So, because my email and my vote are stored together, so someone will learn who I've voted. So you need to trust the server, the device, but now you also additionally need to trust the administrator, because the administrator of this form, because, for example, if I see, well, everyone votes no, but I really want it to be yes, I can just replace the labels, right? So I can edit the form, I can replace no by yes and yes by no, and then suddenly everyone has voted for the other option, so not really good. So, you know, let's use super secure internet voting system trademark. Is this now a good voting system? So I'm mocking a bit kind of industry, of course. No idea. It could very well be, but from the screenshot, you can't tell. So, you know, you might go to their web page and try to find out how they solve their problems. So this one is very nice, because even when anonymity is turned on, our authentication system keeps it trackable. So they kind of achieve anonymity and not anonymity at the same time, which is very impressive. I'll let you read the text. So ironically, this system also published a specification, and the specification is not that bad. But this text is just bullshit. So the French also, you know, they can also contribute. So what they do is they use sovereign geometric models. I have no idea what this means, and I think science would be interested to know what they have invented, but it's unclear. Or, you know, just a good old stock photo register trademark phrase combination. So, but let's skip to the boring part. So what can we do? So how can we judge a system? As with any computer software, as with any software, with any project, you first need to know the requirements. So what does a system need to achieve to be secure? And what we're going to do is a good old-fashioned security analysis. We'll have our system, and we try to judge, well, our system is against an adversary, so this is someone who wants to attack our system. We have some people we trust, so some assumptions we are allowed to take, and then the system should achieve some properties. And let's go through these parts one by one. So first, adversary, who attacks? So one thing that could also count as an attack, but maybe a very weak one, is accidental bugs. So maybe you're just, you know, you're giving your best, but you're just a little bit incompetent, aren't we all? There are some bugs. This is where most software usually stops. So you have to defend against accidental bugs. You do it via testing, you do it via, you know, customer support. This is where most systems can stop. For voting system, you know, let's step up the game, let's have a rogue employee. So your system is perfect, but just one guy, just, you know, he wants the voting result to be different. This actually happened in Switzerland not too long ago. It was in Stadtschreiber von of Frauenfeld. So Stadtschreiber is the highest administrative boss, kind of. So, and he has keys to everything, and he used those keys, and he used those keys to add paper ballots. So in some office, the paper ballots that came in, they were stored, and he added some to change the seat allocation. And after the ballots that were added, another party got another seat. But the party that lost the seat kind of did a did a statistical analysis, and they said, well, this is very weird. Can you please investigate? And then they investigated, and then found, well, some of these paper ballots, they're not folded, and they don't really look used. And then if you take out these ballots, you receive at the result you would expect. So this was kind of paper voting that here was attacked. But you can get stronger, you can get to nation state adversary, short form NSA. I will not go into nation state adversaries, but just some screenshot of a Canadian report, what happens in Ukraine, where Russians are in some networks, they probably shouldn't be. But if you're building a voting system, this is who you're defending against. So people that can spend considerable effort, considerable time to try to erode trust or to change the result of your system. Or, you know, just a good old script kiddie that has too much time on their hands and I'm not charging my laser. So, good. But then who can you trust? So let's look at who is involved in the system. So you have the institution itself, the institution of who you, for which you vote, kind of. The institution knows who is allowed to vote, so the electorate, knows the committees, the candidates, the election rules, and so on. You have the system that then implements these rules, and you have the voters as who are the end users. So let's first look at the first two. They're usually hardly separate. So for voting system, for paper voting, for voting booth, institution, and system are usually the same people. And there is a lot of things that happen in this process. So you start with the voting list, you print out kind of the stuff for the voters, you send it, it lands in their voting box, in their postal box, they vote, you receive it back, you store it, you transport it to be counted, it's summed up, and so on. So there's a lot going on, there's a lot of people involved. This is complicated to analyze. And on the other hand, you have end users that are not really able to protect themselves, so in internet voting specifically. So it's just one example, but I mean, even if you know, so this would obviously break vote privacy. So if you use this, to vote, 4 months later, someone gets access to your computer and just goes back in time and see how you voted. But even apart from this, if you're not using Windows, are you really sure what's running on your system? Yeah, not everyone has the... Yeah. For most people, the choice essentially, do I trust Google, do I trust Apple? And they're both... So what do you do in traditional systems? How do you make this process above a bit less scary? So you use the four eyes principle. So this means... whether it be four eyes doesn't really matter, but at least two person would take care that the processes are executed correctly. So when you're counting, it's not just one person that marks, well, candidate A plus one, it's always two person. And the same should happen throughout the chain. So when you're printing, you have people observing, when you're storing, when you're guarding those boxes. If you're doing it digitalized, you can generalize this, so you know the amount of person that fit in a room is not really relevant anymore. You can do it one out of n. So n stands for any number, so you can have one out of four servers whatever. So you can kind of generalize this four eyes principle. And because it's digitalized, you cannot really see what's going on anymore, but you have more tools available. One thing you can do is verifiable execution. So the thing that is executed is actually provable. So you have some machine that has to execute an algorithm, and it will give you the result of this algorithm, but it will also give you a proof. And then another part of the system can check whether this proof is correct, and if it is, then this means, well, also the result is correct. And you can take this even one step further. You can audit these proofs even independently. So some of these proofs you have to keep within the system. Some of the proofs you can even give to election observers. So this makes the proof stronger, but of course the best thing is always no trust. Some of the algorithms, some of the things you do, there's no algorithm know how you can make this verifiable or even provable by third parties. So some things that happens on the voter device is probably something that you just want no trust in the voter device. So, and then in the end, we want to achieve properties. So, of course, this depends on the election setting you're in, so on the society you're voting for or on the government you're voting for. But all elections probably will be hard why elections wouldn't fulfill human rights. So that's why I'm doing the argument here. The human rights is very general. I didn't even shorten this phrase. So I cut off start and end, but I didn't remove any essential. And it just says universal, equal, secret, and free. But it's not too clear what this means. So there are other institutions that formulate what this exactly means. And in e-voting, what applies most is Council of Europe, which gave out recommendations for e-voting for elections. So perfect. This I shortened very much. This is a document that is 20, 30 pages of a bit legalese. But it's a good guideline. It's well made. And so kind of this is the legal side, and then you try to transfer this into properties you can prove or you can work with as a scientist or as an industry. And the two properties that are security critical is verifiability and privacy. This is just the terminology that is used. Verifiability is kind of like correctness. So what you want in the end, that the final tally has the correct votes of all eligible voters. So every adjective in here is important. So eligible means the voter is actually allowed to take part in this election. So you don't have any votes from voters that are not, you know, that are not even part of your government. And correct means the votes have not been modified. And privacy means nothing leaks except the election result. So also why the formulation except the election result? Because some election results do leak kind of how you voted. So easiest example, everyone votes for candidate A. So of course you know everyone has voted for candidate A. So this is just accept the election result. And then if you think about this a bit further, for verifiability, this is kind of, you cast your vote and it has to be correctly cast. So it cannot be modified. Then it has to be stored somewhere. It has to, again, reach the tally, and in the tally it has to be summed up correctly. And it's a whole chain, so from where you cast your ballot until the end, and this has to hold. For privacy, you want that the plain vote cannot be attributed to the voter, ever. So also, in 20 years, what you have voted now should not be known to anyone. So this also means for those used to encryption, quantum computers are also something you should think about and defend already now, because if you have the slightest fear that your vote will be exposed in 20 years, you might vote different, which is something we should definitely avoid. And you also want kind of voters that try to attempt to prove how they voted. You want to avoid this because else their votes become sellable. So let's say you have some malicious candidate that says, well, I give you $20 if you vote for me. And if you're able to give him a receipt, look, I really voted for you, then he will pay you. So voters must not get a receipt. And importantly, both of these properties, they have to hold end to end. So if you have verifiability in 99% of the system, but 1% is trivially broken, you have gained nothing. The same with privacy, if it's not attributable in most of the system, but in one place it still is, you've again lost. So this is our security analysis. So to bring this point home, let's compare it to other voting systems. No, let's first compare it to e-banking. So is e-banking a fundamentally different problem? Yes, it is, because you don't have privacy and you don't need to. If you go to a bank and you ask the bank teller what's on my account, he will tell you the exact number and it would be okay for you. If you go to your government and ask them who have I voted for, they will hopefully not be able to tell. But without privacy, everything becomes much easier. You can just log everything. You don't need to build multiple servers that execute e-banking in parallel. You can remove a lot of the complexity, and by this, it becomes a lot easier. Then the voting booth, we've already seen in the beginning. The difference is here, you really have physical control. And then again, you have this receipt mechanism. You don't need verifiable execution and so on. You have this randomized audit. This works. For postal voting, you kind of remove the physical control, but you still have this, I call it heavily distributed trust, so you have a lot of people that are involved that are maybe not too trustworthy, but they have little effect on the voting result. And so we're back to the internet voting system. Good, so I have four slides to convince you that such a system can be built. So how, in general, does it work? So you cast the votes, then you authenticate, and then because this is a verifiable internet voting system, you verify that, you know, the cast and authentication was successful. And then in the end, there's a tally phase where you tally all the votes that you have recorded. So let's go to a system. Let's make an example with the system. I'm not going to go into cryptographic details because I want to focus on other things, but let's see how this can be solved. So to cast the votes, your user interface actually could look exactly the same as the Google Forms approach. But under the hood, it would need to encrypt the vote. And it would use something that is called a threshold public key system. So this means you can encrypt the vote with a key that is publicly known. And it can only be decrypted by a threshold, which means multiple authorities have to together decrypt. And this would assume one of these authorities remains honest. So one of these authorities will only decrypt your vote if the whole election has run according to protocol. And it certainly wouldn't decrypt your vote too soon and so on. So this is the threshold in this. So you encrypt it, and then only if people come together, they can decrypt it again. You would then authenticate. Here you can use the equivalent of signatures, but just in a digital form, which essentially in this proposal requires you to enter a very long string. And then you would verify. So this is aligned to the Swiss context. In the Swiss context, you kind of get a code back from the server. And then you would compare whether this code is the same code as you have printed out on your voting material. So this means before the election, you get voting material by postal mail. And for this, for every choice you can make, you have a unique return code. These return codes are different for every voter, and they're different for every choice. Then after you've cast your vote, you will compare whether this return code compares with the one on your voting sheet. And then you know, well, it has been recorded correctly, and sufficient servers have received my vote. So, and then the tally, there's no image here, the tally happens after the voting phase has closed. What you have now, you have for every voter, you have a encryption of its vote, but you kind of know to which vote it belongs because they send it to you over the internet. So it would be, you don't want to assume this is anonymous. So you have the ciphertext and you kind of know to whom it belongs. And what a verified shuffle does, it shuffles the list of ciphertext. All ciphertext, it shuffles this, and it re-encrypts them. So why does it re-encrypt them? Because if you re-encrypt, the ciphertext changes, so kind of the bits and bytes, they're completely different, but the plain text remains the same. So you do not change what's inside the ciphertext, but you change completely how it looks, while at the same time changing the order. So kind of, you do this a couple of times, so you give this to one server, you give you a list of ciphertext, and it outputs you a completely different list of ciphertext. And importantly, it's verified. So they will give you a proof that the re-encryption did not modify the plain text. And this proof you can verify independently. Okay, so putting this together, you have some servers in some servers one after the other. Every server re-encrypts and shuffles and gives you a proof. And you do this a couple of times until and on. If one of these servers is actually honest and really shuffles the order, then at the end, you will have lost to whom the ciphertext belongs. And then you can safely decrypt. And because we've seen in the casting, we use the threshold encryption scheme, so no one can do this earlier. So to summarize this, let me do some bold claims. So for casting, for tally, and for verification, these are well understood. They're practical, they're in use, also in production. And they can effectively reduce trust. So in the tally phase, as long as one of the servers is honest, I get my privacy. But even if all servers are dishonest, they cannot change the votes because the proofs do not work. So this is very good. For authentication and verification, it depends a lot what do you have available. So for example, for authentication, you can use digital signatures. If you are in Estonia, you have an EID card. On this EID card, there is already a way to sign it, so you can reuse this EID card. In the Swiss context, you have to send postal mail, so you have to trust the postal service to deliver this to you, and so on. So here, the analysis gets complicated, and it depends a lot on your context, whether it's realistic or not. Good. So then let's turn back to state of industry. So I actually did a market analysis in the last couple of months, not just that, but 2 or 3 months ago. And there's a lot of companies that claim to provide e-voting. This is a LinkedIn of one of these companies. Now, I didn't go into details of these cryptographic algorithms, but they're complicated and they're not, you know, they're very context specific. They're not used all over the place. If you develop an internet voting system, you probably have to develop this on your own. Now, unless they have two very rock star developers, I don't think it's realistic they really have done this. Another thing, if you want to claim that you reached this, so you have privacy and verifiability, verifiability means others can verify that your system works correctly. So if you don't even publish the specification, this is very hard to do for others. Some companies at least publish their specification, so this is better, but now we're really 10 to 20 companies, so it's really not a lot. And then some companies go further. So this is a Swiss company. They're not doing this out of the goodness, out of their heart. It's legally required for them to do this. But they publish a lot, so essentially everything except the internal administration tools. But they publish the complete source code, they publish specification, and importantly also proofs, because the specification is 100, 150 pages. You need proofs to be sure that that there are no mistakes. The proofs are also 100 and 150 pages, but you know, architecture documentation and so on. But you know, this is a lot of material. You also need people to actually review it. And these need to be experts, which also needs a lot of resources and money. This is done in Switzerland. Every time they find something, every time the system gets improved. And here we're really at very few companies. But on the very far right, we're also in the, you know, nation state election, nation state adversary case. So maybe if you're using a system for an association, this is a bit overkill. But you know, this is where we should go. So let's do a case study of Switzerland. Sorry, it's always Switzerland, but I'm from Switzerland. So 2005, this is an industry system. So I don't want to particularly shame this industry system, so I'm not going to name names. But it's a very good example in my opinion. So 2005, this industry system was used for the first time, security by Trust Me Bro. So this was 20 years ago. Research wasn't as far as it is now, but also transparency wasn't legally required, so it wasn't done. Then this system remains in use in Switzerland, so throughout this whole time. But then 2011 and 2013, it's also used in Norway. Norway mandated public review of this system. In both elections, experts said, well, this is not that great. In both elections, they had at least one critical bug. So in one election, for example, they encrypted some of the votes really weakly before they fixed this bug during the election. This is not good. In Switzerland, it remained in use. Everyone was happy. So then 2015, in Switzerland, new legislation came into force, which required a part of verifiability. So in the properties talk, I said, well, verifiability has to hold from start to end. Industry wasn't as far then, so verifiability held up to some point, not until the end, up to some point, and the system claimed, well, we implement this. But again, nothing was published. These reports remained private. So I'm writing here now quality by Trust Me Pro, because there was some kind of security that was achieved, although it wasn't really clear which one. And at this point, also one part of Australia, so New South Wales, thought, well, this is a very good system, let's use it. Then 2019, the system, the company that was operating this system in Switzerland, so through the new legislation, they could only provide it to 10% of the electorate. But they wanted to reach more. And to do this, they had to undergo public review, finally. And in 2019, they attempted this. This didn't go as planned because the system was shut down afterwards. Funnily enough, at the same time, Australia was using this system in production. So there was an active election going on. They said, we have no problems. 4 months after, said, we might have had some problems. The system was looked at, and the reports that was released 2019 actually are very close to the reports released 2013 and 2011. So nothing on the system, so the system seemed to not have been fundamentally improved in all this time because transparency, you know, wasn't legally required. And then the system also finds its end in Australia in 2022. The system crashed during the election. The judge revoked the internet votes and the people had to re-vote. So it's easy to make fun of this. For me, this is a history about loss because everyone in this scenario lost. So the election organizers couldn't plan. They couldn't account that the system would actually run. So 2019, some Swiss cantons had this system. They wanted to use it. Suddenly it wasn't usable anymore. So this means people that were relying on the system, like people with disabilities, suddenly had to find another solution. And you know, you cannot long-term plan and you erode in some way trust. You have the system operator that received, you know, a lot of public shaming, some of it probably justified, some of it probably not, and loss in revenue. So for the system provider, this wasn't the only issue they had, but it didn't end well. So 2020, they went bankrupt, probably not because of this, just to, but then, you know, if you're in default, that doesn't mean the company stops existing. You're able to renovate your finances and so on. This probably didn't work because I read 2 or 3 months ago, I think they're now really in default. So really, really. So also for the system operator, this strategy of keeping everything private and hoping that this remains like this didn't work out. And of course, then for the voters, because they paid for this and they needed to recast the vote also in Australia. So what I want you to take from the slide, transparency helps everyone, even if it's a bit painful at the start. So are certificates enough? No. There's 2 certificates that I'm aware of that one might think help you to choose a good system. So one is this ISO certification, information security management, but it's already a bit in the name. So it's about information security management. It's not about your information security is really good. So of course, if your management system is appropriate, your security will also improve, but it doesn't say anything whether your internet voting system, for example, is appropriate or not. So of course it will be harder to get the certification if you have a complete garbage system, but this is not what this certificate is for. The certificate is that we have a structured approach to information security. So if you do this, it's obviously a big bonus, but it doesn't mean your system actually fulfills all of these things that we've seen in this talk. And there's another thing in from Germany. So the BSI gives out a common criteria. So common criteria established for a product category that your product is good in this category. But the problem here is it is rather concrete. So it cannot consider, well, the context in this association is different than the context in this association. It has to reduce to some specific case. And unfortunately, the case they reduced to is very weak from a trust assumption thing. So essentially, you trust the voting device, you trust the servers, you trust the administrator. So, you know, again, the certificate is good because it means you're able to structurally analyze the system and you have at least thought about it. But if these assumptions that are taken in the certificates, if they don't apply to your organization, this certificate is not useful to you. Good, so let me finish the talk with internet voting in 3 easy steps. So first, we need e-voting. So we've seen the advantages and disadvantages. They will be different in your context. Do they turn out in your favor or not? And then if you if you're convinced they do, or you know, if someone else took the decision that they do, you should start with a security analysis. We've seen a bit how this works. So are you fearing rogue employees? Are you fearing nation-state adversaries? These are different systems you would need to choose afterwards. And then, yeah, who do you need to trust and how can you reduce this? And then in the end, you know, is there a system actually available that can provide this? And, you know, are they convincing? So, which concludes my talk. And I'm happy to have some critical questions.
Right. We have quite a lot of time for questions, and Florian will also answer questions in German and French, if it helps. So, any questions? Raise your hands up.
Du sagtest, ich soll nicht wissen, wen ich gewählt habe. Ist es erlaubt, dass jemand weiß, dass ich gewählt habe?
Depends on your context. So. I know in some jurisdiction this is okay. So for example in Australia, of course, because you will receive a fine or not. So of course someone knows whether you've voted or not. I'm not sure. I'm sure in some jurisdiction this is allowed to be public, whether you voted or not.
So next question. All right.
So if I understood it correctly, at the beginning you showed, hey, in Australia we noticed a big increase in votes, and then in other study you showed, hey, but the results aren't really different. So even with e-voting, the results are not significantly different, exactly, in Geneva. That marks the question, is this extra effort really worth it?
It depends. So in Geneva you had this study and it was a good place to do this study because you had it over a longer time. You had villages that had and had not, so you can make a statistic analysis. And in this case for the general public, it was people that voted per postal mail, they now voted online. So you kind of had this shift in technology, but seemingly not of the people that actually voted. So maybe this is a more personal perspective. What I expect is that e-voting will still be more convenient because honestly it sucks having this letter and having to bring to the postal thing. If I can just do it online, that seems more convenient. What could be is that there's a long effect. So it's not within elections, but it could be over 10 or over 20 years that people get more and more dissatisfied of voting in such an ancient way and they want to do e-voting. Personally, I think this is one of the motivation why it's pursued as much in Switzerland. So there's a strategic vision. We need to have this at some point. Let's build up expertise and let's build up a system that we can introduce slowly, gradually, so we have it ready when people actually demand it. Maybe that's my answer.
About the bit where you shuffle the votes.
Yeah, I don't have a good graph for this.
So you're doing that on multiple servers in parallel, right? So wouldn't it be enough for one server to be dishonest in that case? So like the state before shuffling, you would know who had each vote. So if I do multiple of them, it would be helpful for the tallying later. But how do you ensure that one dishonest one can't leak who voted if multiple are doing the shuffling.
So okay, multiple are doing the shuffling, yes, but they're doing it in Siri, not in parallel. So you have one server. Okay, now it already makes sense. So you have one server that shuffles, proves that the shuffling has not modified the plaintext, and they give it to the next, and give it to the next, and give it to the next. And in the end, the people with this threshold key, they will check, well, are all these proofs correct? And if they are, they say, well, at least one of the server probably shuffled correctly, so let's decrypt now. So the problem is a bit there, how can you prove that you actually shuffled correctly? You cannot really prove that the servers have used randomness. So that's why you need to, that's why you want to distribute it to multiple servers, and then, yeah, one of these is probably honest.
So you skipped the cryptographic basics in this talk, but I'm very interested in that. So are there any resources that you can recommend, such as for reading up on that, or any talk or something you know?
Yeah, sure. Let's talk after the talk. Yeah.
Thanks.
So I can drop some buzzwords. So essentially what you need are zero knowledge proofs. And with the zero knowledge proofs, you're able to prove a statement without revealing the proof of that statement. So in this case, you say, well, I didn't modify, I re-encrypted. Okay, I don't know how to formulate this intuitively. but in this case, the zero knowledge proof would just prove, well, I re-encrypted, but I didn't change the plain words. That's kind of the magic. And the zero knowledge proofs, they're a complicated building block. But yeah, you can make them do that.
Your graph here begins with casting the vote. Is there any way to verify that the people who are actually able to cast the vote are the franchise that we intend to be able to vote?
So whether they are eligible?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Good question. It depends on which setting you're in. For example, in Estonia, this authentication part is done using their electronic ID. And this electronic ID is used a lot in their daily life. So for example, you can sign legally binding contracts. And because it's used a lot in their society, they assume, well, if someone could trivially break the system, so could trivially insert people that don't actually exist, they will probably use this capability also, you know, to make some money on the side. And this doesn't happen, so probably these EID cards, there is one for every real person that exists. So that is their trust assumption. In the Swiss system, the trust assumption is over postal mail. So you deliver every voter one letter to their home, which has one of these initialization codes. And if you don't have one of these codes, well, your vote will not be counted.
I have a similar question about coercing the voters, because you said you don't get a receipt when online voting, so that you can't like send it to someone that gives you money for a specific vote.
Yes.
But for as well as in non-online voting, with paper you also don't get a receipt, of course. But for online voting, you can be forced to vote like on your PC by another person in some way. How is there a statistic on maybe that, or do you know anything about that?
No, I don't know a statistic. But this, so what you're referring to is known as family voting. So it's not always kind of someone holds a gun to your head and makes you vote something specific. It could also be that, you know, someone in your family or the family votes together and looks at each other's votes and kind of checks how everyone votes. So this is kind of in general, if you do remote voting, where you cannot physically control the voters, so you cannot physically make sure they're alone in their voting cabin, in their voting booth, there you always have this threat that there's this family voting going on. And yeah, the answer here is again, it depends on the society, whether this is acceptable to face or not. In Switzerland, it's assumed this does not happen too much. But I don't know any clear numbers or a study. Personally, it would surprise me if this is a huge problem in Switzerland, but you know, that's not really a scientific statement.
Thank you for the talk. My question is, so we have, if I understand correctly, this verifiability, which is a very mathematic property of saying the votes were proven to be cast and tallied correctly. But as far as I understand it, one major problem of e-voting systems is the transparency aspect. So that basically a normal average layperson can reproduce the results, which is very easy for manual voting. And how could this be implemented with a system like this?
So that's a difficult question. So first, in traditional voting, you can you know, you can look at how these paper ballots are passed around. But still, arguably for a single voter, it's hard to see how the whole system functions. So also there you have some limits in what you can observe. In this case, you have this trade-off that is done electronically, which per se you don't see anything about it. And this trade-off is resolved by you outputting proofs that can then be verified by auditors. So you can apply this to the normal voter by giving these proofs to the normal voter, and then they would execute some audit application on their device. I'm not sure this is a very good argument, because of course they wouldn't understand how the audit application works, so does this really improve matter? But it's always a trade-off. So you have this, you want the election system to be understandable, but to what extent? So as far as I understood in Germany, the argument at the moment is the major steps have to be understood. What is a major step? I don't know. But yeah, it doesn't stand in isolation. It's in trade-offs against other things your system should be. So it should also be secure, it should be usable, it should reach the general population.
Just as a short notice, I get the questions, so raise your hands up higher so I can see where I have to go.
Yeah. Can you go to slide 28, please?
Yes.
You have the token there, and I think you said that this token is dependent on the option that was voted for and written in the letter.
Yes.
So that would act as a receipt then as well?
That and depends on how you define a receipt. Okay. So, yeah.
So I could take a screenshot of that.
You could take a screenshot, yeah. But you can also film yourself voting.
Yeah, okay. No.
That's the problem. You don't have physical control over the voter. So also in a voting booth, yeah. You would prevent them from, you know, filming, or you would try to. But if they are at home, they can do the same thing if there are paper ballots. But so this scheme is receipt free for cryptographers, because you don't get a... This is also an argument, but you don't get a digital signatures, for example. I have voted yes, digital signatures. You don't go as far. So it's at least not provable. But you know, this is a this is a thin line.
For this approach with letter sent, how can for this approach with return codes, can you also verify that this is not manipulated, or can we post to whatever we want and nobody will ever know?
Also good question. So on the next slide, I'm saying, well, authenticate, verify, these have trade-offs, and you usually introduce trust assumptions. So if you have the return code on your screen and you compare it to your paper ballot, you're of course assuming your paper ballot is correct. Or sorry, not paper ballot, the thing you received over postal mail, you're of course assuming this has been generated correctly and honestly. So at some point, there was a printer that was working correctly, and at some point, this printer received correct information. So this is the trust assumption you introduce to make this verification possible. To answer this question, so how could you, again, then reduce this trust assumption? What you could do, and what you always can do, are randomized audits. So you have 100 voters, you generate 110 voting material, you randomly pick 10 and you check whether the return codes and what you send and so on, whether this really matches. But yeah, that would be one way to make the system stronger. I don't know whether this is currently done in Switzerland.
So we don't want to trust devices. And am I understanding it correctly that this is ensured by these unique codes for every possible vote that the voters get?
Yeah, so on the, in this case, I'm going back to the codes. So these codes protect you against your own voter device. It doesn't protect you against, to some extent it also protects you against malicious server, but the prime idea here is your voting device cannot verify you, cannot modify your vote. Because if it would need to guess the correct return codes, and because these are long enough, it's not realistic. That's the idea here. But if you hear about trusting your voter's device, so if I enter my vote like this, my voter device learns my vote. So this is also not a trade-off that is considered in a Swiss context, because at the moment the idea is, well, it also has to be easy to use. This is probably the easiest way to use this. This is something that can be challenged. But so here you trust your voter's device for privacy, because it learns your vote, but you don't trust it for verifiability because what your voter device is doing is checked by these return codes.
So I gave my best. Sadly, we don't have any time. Florian, where can we meet you after this?
There.
All right. You heard it, and then some applause for Florian again.
Thanks.
GPMM.